are synergies on both sides. American companies still struggle to get into China. Facebook is blocked, Google is blocked, Twitter's blocked. American internet companies are around the world except China.
I'm Steve Stein, and this is Inside Asia. My guest is Rebecca Fannin, journalist, author, entrepreneur, and founder of Silicon Dragon Ventures. Rebecca started off as a journalist, then made a remarkable transition to advise corporate clients and investors on the China tech scene. I started by asking about that unlikely journey that ultimately led to the founding of Silicon Dragon Ventures.
I was at Red Herring magazine as international news editor in Silicon Valley during the height of the dot-com boom, and also during the height of the dot-com bust. This led the venture capitalists who were gained to go to Asia and China and India primarily back then. And I basically was reporting on venture capital in Silicon Valley, and it began to have this China and India slant to it. So I started going to Beijing and Shanghai and getting to know some of the VC funds as they were setting up, or initially just looking around and thinking about whether they were going to do it. But then once they started to invest in China primarily, I began interviewing them and then their portfolio companies, the founders of these companies such as Alibaba and Baidu and Focus Media and RenRen and Dang Dang and many others, the ones that became the leaders of China's internet landscape. And that was very early days.
What was the feeling that, you know, after the dot-com bust? Was it that, well, if it's not happening in the U.S., maybe it's happening elsewhere? Or they were late in catching up and therefore they could catch the wave earlier in places like India and China?
Well, they were the pioneers. There was not much going on in Silicon Valley except for write-downs of portfolio companies. No funds were being raised, no new investments were being made. It was fairly bleak. So many of those who were the early pioneers started bringing along some of the Sand Hill Road veterans from Sequoia, NEA, Draper, you know, the leading firms. And their eyes were open.
It was a mixed result, though, wasn't it, Rebecca? I mean, some basically, turned tail and left after just a few short years, and others morphed and changed, and some did stay the course. But what were some of the key learnings for these groups early on?
Yeah, it definitely depended on their strategy for the region. If they were just parachuting in and looking around easily for deals, then they didn't make it. If, however, they built local teams and Chinese language speakers and set up funds in the region, then they had a much better shot at it. There were some failures of the leading venture firms in China and India, but those who made it, such as Sequoia, made it big time.
Yeah, they did.
People like Neil Shen of Sequoia Capital China. There's no argument of his success.
Right.
And, yeah, on the Forbes Midas list, number one. So this was not the case even just 5 years ago.
And it's changed. And I want to come back to talk a little bit about the VC environment today versus when you wrote the book and you first, ventured into China. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about some of the companies that you profiled in your book. And I guess at that point, 10 years back, it's a bit of a crapshoot. You look at the ones that feel like they've got the momentum and they have the potential. But there's some interesting stories in there, including Lingtu, which is the digital map making business, Beijing Oriental Wisdom Technology Group, which is kind of a Reuters meets Schwab, I guess, is something like that, is I think how you describe it. Pinko, which is most advanced, a rich text messaging group, maybe like today's WhatsApp or WeChat. What have come of these businesses, and why did you pick those to begin with?
Well, one of the reasons that would lead me to pick one company to write about over another is the entrepreneur behind it. So, for instance, in Pinko's case, when I met the entrepreneur there at Tsinghua Software Park, he impressed me that he was somebody who was determined and persistent and creative enough. And his the technology was ahead of its time. It was basically instant messaging bypassing the telecom network. So now this is, you know, where technology has taken us. Oriental Wisdom was about selling financial products over mobile. It was ahead of its time. And the entrepreneur behind it was a very passionate, determined guy. And so, yeah, I would pick them based upon kind of that gut feeling of that they might succeed. And some of them have not really broken through, certainly to the level of a company like Baidu or Alibaba, which had, you know, these, in the case of Alibaba, such a charismatic leader as Jack Ma, or in the case of Robin Lee, you know, someone who had support from his team and his co-founder, and you know, a great manager, and certainly a search guru when search was the ultimate. And so, it has been very interesting to watch these companies grow up. I think in the case of RenRen, Joe Chen has pivoted RenRen into an investment company.
And for the listeners, tell them what RenRen is.
RenRen started out as the Facebook of China.
Mm.
And it was started by a Stanford grad. He raised a lot of money for his time. And it was way ahead, but it was got overtaken by companies such as Tencent in social messaging. And so RenRen, you know, it still exists today as a Facebook-style platform for China. But Joe Chen has basically taken out all the companies that he invested in and set up an entirely different company, private company. And so this is financial engineering in a way, and it's very interesting to watch how these companies have evolved.
You know, it's interesting how, and I like how you focused in on the founders, the personalities behind these businesses. And it sounds like that was very much borrowing a page from Silicon Valley, you know, where it was really this founder, charismatic startup guys who it wasn't so much the business models, but it was just the tenacity or even the charisma that kind of got them over that first hurdle. Do you find in China that same ingredient bears out, or is it different in Silicon Valley, China? You know, in the Silicon Valley equivalent in China.
No, I think it's the same.
Mm. But it is.
People said to me, like David Chow of DCM Ventures, one of the leading investors in Asia, said definitely there will be a Steve Jobs emerging from Asia. I think we've seen that.
In a guy like Jack Ma, for instance, who is an interesting story in and of himself, you know, a basically English teacher in kind of a secondary city with no necessarily strong technical skills or training or expertise, and but just a vision and an idea and grit is kind of the impression I have of him. Is that your impression? Is that how he's been able to muscle through just based on being determined?
Yeah, I mean, he is not a quitter. And that has helped him many times. Alibaba almost failed back in the dot-com downturn. And through sheer tenacity and teamwork and bringing in outside help, he managed to turn around Alibaba and, you know, basically break through. He's a master at bringing in experts. Who can help to raise the level of Alibaba, like Jerry Yang did, like SoftBank. You know, he had SoftBank behind him. He had Jerry Yang behind him. He had GDV Capital behind him. You know, he had some of the major players behind Alibaba. And not that to say that it was never easy. He was turned down by most of the Sand Hill Road investors in the early days. But, you know, once they got over this dot-com hurdle, They targeted eBay viciously and won that battle. They were on a roll.
So it was as much as the quality and nature of the people he hired into the business as the technology itself that got them where they are today?
I think so, yeah. Today, I see Alibaba innovating in new ways, such as in e-retailing. And Alibaba has done has played a diversification strategy in a big way, getting into many, many areas of the internet. And this is almost like a defensive strategy to keep other players away. Alibaba can own fintech, can own logistics, can own e-commerce, can own e-retailing, you know, ride sharing. These are massive opportunities.
You know, it also feels familiar. You know, you look across all of Asia and the large family-owned Asian conglomerates that got into all kinds of businesses were typically the ones that survive, almost a portfolio approach to balancing things out. If logistics was up and, you know, something like retail was down, they survived. They could get through. Is that a similar approach that you think he was taking, or is it just he was going to build an ecosystem second to none within the tech space?
Yeah, I think he's always had the big vision of wanting to own the retail market, and for Alibaba to go global and to be globally known. So he's a big visionary thinker, he has the skills to motivate the team.
This is Inside Asia. My guest is Rebecca Fannin, author of Silicon Dragon, How China is Winning the Tech Race, a book she wrote 10 years ago at a time when China's tech companies were on the rise. Since then, she's established a consulting practice, hosts events, and offers consulting services to investors keen on the China market. Let's get back to our conversation. I asked Rebecca to flesh out a key point in her book around the challenge of Chinese tech leadership as China-based organizations look beyond their home borders to go global. What are some of the specific challenges, and what are Chinese companies doing to prepare for that bigger agenda?
The talent issue is still a major issue. And I think in the early days, it was really about expats coming in, expats and also returnees coming in. But now it's developed much more as a localized environment. China's developing its own talent internally, and those people are, for instance, the head of Meituan, Dianping, he has, he's trained in China, experienced in China, and is now behind one of the leading unicorns in China. It's interesting that he's the same guy who helped to develop Renren's technology back earlier on. Mm-hmm. I think there is still a talent gap between Silicon Valley and China.
It's funny, you reference at one point Lingtu and how the founder was displaced by the CEO and the CFO from China.com, which was a very successful, or at the time, a successful Hong Kong-listed play. And they're both Hong Kong Chinese, kind of airdropped in to take over. But that didn't end up working out, did it? It kind of backfired. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. This is when you bring in someone who doesn't fit the company culture or the country culture, it just doesn't work. I mean, this is the same story with Steve Jobs when he was, you know, ousted and then came back. It's often that the founder who is the leader, and there's no replacing that leader. So in many cases, this has been the same scenario. Robin Lee is still there. He was there in the day one. He's still there. Jack Ma, day one, still there. Pony Ma, day one, still there.
Right.
They're the most successful.
Do you suspect that some of the companies that aren't on our radar today might be, had they swapped out, even if it were, you know, other China-based executives bringing in basically those organizations, those individuals that could scale a business? Or do you think that just the nature of startups, it's always a better choice to stick with the founder, stick with the vision and see it through and make sure investors play ball?
Well, I think today, as these companies go to the next level and they're looking to go public, many of them most of them have brought in outside CFOs. Mm. They need that. to get to the next level. But the founder stays in place, but the team around them builds out, and particularly the CFO is a very key position as they scale up and go global and go public, actually.
Well, that's a tricky one, isn't it, Rebecca? I mean, that's where, you know, it seems to be multi-tiered in there, where at the one hand, you know, if you do have outside investors, they sometimes and oftentimes require greater transparency, you know, clearer communication, you know, getting rid of, process-oriented reporting, KPIs. I mean, these are things that many startups just aren't familiar with. They're too focused on their market or their product. Yet, you know, bringing CFOs into these environments, typically the ones originally, I guess I noticed, they were coming out of large multinationals where they had lots of resource. And frankly, they were a little bit rudderless when they hit the ground and started working with these startups. Where today are the Chinese startups finding CFO talent?
Well, I was just thinking of Xiaomi, that the Chinese smartphone maker who had hired Google executive to come in, this Google executive, Hugo Vera, ended up working primarily in India and building out Xiaomi's business, and was very successful in building out the business in India. He's since left the company. I think he was there 2 or 3 years. And so I think, you know, in some cases they are bringing in talent from Silicon Valley companies, and you know, it can be a tough assignment for people who are used to the Silicon Valley lifestyle to live in China, live in Beijing, and deal with the pollution. You know, the fellow who was brought in to run the day-to-day operations of Baidu just returned to Silicon Valley.
That's a really interesting point, because it's funny, when I was doing recruiting in this space, you know, we speak with people all across the U.S. and Europe, you know, Chinese nationals that had gone overseas, maybe gotten their PhD or their degrees overseas, maybe worked for 7-10 years, but just it was the environment, it was getting them back into a lifestyle that they could somehow rationalize, that was different from, you know, living on the California coast or in you know, outside of Paris or whatever the case may be, is a pretty tough thing to leave. That was one of our biggest barriers. I mean, are there other things? I mean, for instance, walking back into China where there's censorship issues and politics and maybe some regulatory issues that might be unfamiliar or sticky, does that prevent people from coming in and working for these China startups?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. But the lifestyle reason and education for their kids and, that's a really big, and healthcare, those are really big issues for them. It's hard to get around those issues. I think with these executives, they're living cross-border lives. They're living in Beijing and Shanghai, and they're also living in Silicon Valley or somewhere else,
right,
or New York area, or Paris, like you said, or London. But, you know, Silicon Valley still seems to be a big feeding ground for the talent.
You know, Rebecca, how is this evolving? I mean, what is your, you know, now let's look maybe 10 years ahead. You know, all of the talk is around, you know, cutting edge technologies and AI and robotics and blockchain. I noticed even Kai-Fu Lee has come out with a book called AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley. And I guess he's making the case that China is in a better position than Silicon Valley to, you know, lead the next wave. Is that his premise?
Well, I think his premise is that we're going to see these two superpowers both advancing. Not that China will get the edge, but that China is catching up quickly to the U.S. in AI.
What do you think?
I think there is this talent gap, and that's the biggest hurdle. And you see Baidu building out its AI labs here in Silicon Valley, and so they do have to come to Silicon Valley. Engineering in China, they have the loads of engineers, but the creativity aspect of it is still more prominent in Silicon, in the West than it is in China.
So it's really the core engineering skills, coding capabilities are in China, but is it more the business model or the application of these technologies that are still wanting in the ecosystem, the Chinese tech startup ecosystem?
Yeah, certainly that's part of it, that commercializing these AI technologies, getting them into the market doing the R&D on it is only step one. Commercializing them is step two. And Silicon and the West has always excelled in marketing and brand expansion. And this is something that the Chinese are learning big time now.
Absolutely. I mean, what are the other concerns within within China about further penalties or tariffs or restrictions to the U.S. market that could somehow undermine the pace and development of China tech?
Well, right. Now, certainly these restrictions have hurt, hampered Chinese companies from investing in the U.S. And there's been a massive slowdown in the investment flows from China into the U.S. If you look at Alibaba's deal to buy MoneyGram, it was blocked, and it was blocked by the U.S. side over security concerns. There's also been concerns about the capital outflows from China, the Chinese companies buying into U.S. companies at too high valuations in non-core sectors. And there's been a block on those kinds of deals, particularly Hollywood-type deals that we're doing an LA event next week, July 25, and that's one of the things that we're exploring in that conference. Yeah, definitely, these blocks are hindrances of both sides. American companies still struggle to get into China. Facebook is blocked, Google is blocked, Twitter's blocked. Chinese and American internet companies are around the world except China.
This is Inside Asia, and you've been listening to my conversation with journalist, author, and entrepreneur Rebecca Fannin, founder of Silicon Dragon Ventures. At the end of every show, I wrap up our conversations with an Asia Insider Minute, where I work to pin down the essential takeaways of the episode. When it comes to the topic of China tech, there are a lot of moving parts, but here's my take. Let's start with the tech playing field. It's changed significantly since a figure like Jack Ma burst onto the scene to take the digital world by storm. I'm not suggesting it was simply a matter of early entry and good fortune. Jack's a tenacious and gritty entrepreneur, and he worked hard and beat the odds. I remember inviting him to Singapore in 1998 to join a panel of e-commerce entrepreneurs at a time when the industry was in its infancy. I watched in amazement as he won hearts and minds with his visionary and some might even say outlandish predictions for our digital future. Jack had a lot to offer, but perhaps most importantly, he had story. That was enough to win investment support from gold-plated investors like Goldman Sachs, Fidelity, and SoftBank. Put those names on your masthead, and it's like telling the Hashemites that the one true God is on your side. Okay, that's probably giving these guys too much credit, but you get my point. In her book, my guest Rebecca Fannin has her take on Alibaba, but as she points out in our conversation, these are very different days. The room is crowded with Alibaba wannabes and even more crowded with heavy-breathing investors who want a piece of the China tech dream. It's too much money chasing too few deals, as the saying goes. The character of the money has changed as well. Today, China's entrepreneurs voice preference for homegrown versus the overseas variety. That's because Chinese venture and corporate investors offer or pretend to offer what China's entrepreneurs crave most, the right connections at all the right levels. Interestingly enough, this shift coincides with the moment when big China tech companies are setting their sights on going global. Of the world's tech giants, China holds 9 of the top 20 spots. Alibaba, ranked 6th in the world, is biting at the heels of Facebook, ranked 5th. And while Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, and Google still dominate, other China companies like Tencent, Baidu, Xiaomi, and JD.com are making big strides. Which isn't to say that China's tech boom is a fait accompli. Barriers to growth loom large and include a burgeoning trade war with the U.S., accusations of intellectual property theft, privacy and regulatory challenges that go hand in hand with international operations, and of course, that thorny issue of leadership. Chinese CEOs and their top team who know that to succeed globally, you have to act locally. It's not that they can't. U.S., Japanese, and European companies have faced similar challenges through the years. Some figure it out, and some don't. In these heady days of change and disruption, it's more than ever about adaptability. And here I'm talking about adapting to new markets ruled by cultures, regulations, and guidelines entirely different from those governing the mainland. I'm not taking anything away from the Alibabas of the world, and I'm certainly not saying that tech innovation isn't a determining factor for success, but as someone who has spent the past decade recruiting and coaching senior executives, I would argue that companies and investors alike continue to undervalue the importance of enlightened and dynamic leadership. If China's tech companies are to prove themselves internationally, building diversity, hiring locally, and encouraging more dynamic versus hierarchical leadership structures are essential ingredients. In other words, in an environment where innovation operates at breakneck, dizzying speed, the human dimension, embodied by the charismatic CEO, may prove to be the key determining factor in China's quest for global tech dominance. The question is, do Chinese corporate owners and investors agree sufficiently to do something about it? That's a wrap. Until next week, I'm Steve Stein, inviting you to come in from the outside on Inside Asia. Join us at www.insideasiapodcast.com to download and listen to any or all of our 59 episodes. And thanks for listening.